Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am John Milford, Chair of the Club's Grown Ups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we will invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Stephen Campbell. Stephen Campbell is an award-winning author, speaker, and mentor to individuals and organizations, known as the Brain Whisperer. He teaches how your mind can be your greatest adversary and, when understood, can be transformed into your greatest friend and ally. After working in hospital administration for 20 years, Stephen acquired his master's degree in information systems and went on to pursue his greatest love, teaching, where he served as a college professor and eventually educational dean for another 20 years. It was as a professor that Stephen developed a curriculum based on brain science to help students end negative thinking, improve their focus and clarity, and ultimately transform their lives. Stephen uses his 20 years of research and university teaching to present easy-to-understand principles that may be applied immediately to improve the quality of your thoughts and lives, while teaching us how to access true power of our minds. He also shares the latest research about how the brain learns and how much of our behavior is based not on the truth, but rather on the truth as we perceive it. So join me in welcoming Stephen Campbell.
Wow, this is going to be so much fun. Where do we start? Let's start with this, okay? Right now, while I am talking to you, you're talking to yourself, oh gosh, thousands of times faster. Now, your brain can do that because when I talk to you, I use words, and when you talk to yourself, you also use words. But when you talk to yourself, you also use pictures and feelings. So when I think of Mary, my wife, I don't think of her with words. I think of how I feel about her and how she's become prettier and prettier to me in the 45 years we've been married. So you really are talking to yourself many, many, many times faster than I'm talking to you right now. But here's the important point, and I need to find, got it right there. That's my important spot. Okay, everybody looking at me? This is my important spot, which means don't miss this, okay? Here we go. While you are talking to yourself, your brain is believing everything you tell it without question.
Ew.
So when you say, this is really hard, do you know what your brain says? Okay. And then it actually makes it hard. And that's its job. That's the scary part. The wonderful part is when you say, this is so easy, you know what the brain says to that? Okay. Now, is what you're saying true? Your brain doesn't even care. And when I heard that in a psychology class years ago, I was really skeptical. And I think one of the best books I've ever read is called Phantoms in the Brain, written by Dr. V.S. Ramachandran out of UC San Diego. Phantoms referred to phantom limbs that have been amputated. And a patient goes into a doctor's office. He'll say, you got to help me. I can't do a thing with my arm. And the doctor may have to say, well, that could be because I amputated their arm 6 months ago. And the patient says, well, you didn't tell my brain that. My brain still thinks it's there. My brain wants to pick things up with it, and it gets itchy and achy. So the brain doesn't care whether what you're saying is true or not. Now, we talked about that last time. Now I want to go deeper. You ready to go deeper? Okay. We want to look again, but more deeply, at the work of Dr. Albert Ellis, who in 1961 wrote A Guide to Rational Living, one of the first books on cognitive psychology and upon which much of my message is based. Dr. Ellis is renowned by psychologists, the second most influential psychologist in the history of psychology. Carl Rogers is usually number one. Freud is number three. Ellis comes in at number two. And what Dr. Ellis suggested, and we now know through decades of research that this is absolutely true, and I'll say it really slowly so you don't miss it, is that everything that you can do today is primarily based on what you say to yourself about yourself today. Now, notice I'm emphasizing the word today. When he came out with this, psychology had a conniption fit. They said, no. The way you are today is because of your childhood and unresolved childhood conflicts. That was Freudianism. That was followed by behaviorism, Dr. B.F. Skinner. Dr. Skinner said, no, it's all cause and effect. That was followed by, it's on your genes, that didn't last too long. That was followed by environmentalism. It's in your environment, your birth order, your culture, your mom, your dad, your sister, brother. And Dr. Ellis came back and he said, you know what, I think they're all true. How could they all be true? Because when you say it and you lock onto it, your brain's job is to make it true. So I'll give you an example. For the first 42 years of my life, I said to myself, I'm really dumb at math. And guess what? I was really dumb at math, okay? But I discovered I'm really good with computers, and I used to be a computer geek and all this. So I got my degree in computer information, began teaching computer classes at various universities. And one day, when the dean came to my office one day, he said, one of our math professors just quit, Steve, so you are our new math professor. I said, I can't do numbers. He said, you want a job? Learn. There's the book. You're teaching math next semester. Well, I freaked out because I needed the job. I ran down to the Rohnert Park Library. This is back in the 80s, way before the internet. And I picked up all the books I could on brain-based learning. That's how this whole thing started. And I began teaching my course based on how the brain learns. And students began saying, you're such a good math teacher. You really are. And then the dean said, all the students saying, I will only take math if Mr. Campbell's my professor because he makes it so easy. And you know what I did? I began switching the message. I began saying, wait a minute. If I'm so smart with computers, I got to be smart with math. And what did my brain say? Okay. Is it true? Don't care. All I care is what you tell me. But I locked onto it, and lo and behold, I got really smart with math and ended up writing 2 college textbooks on software and what? Math. Was it magical? No, it's the message I'm going to share with you tonight. Your brain believes what you tell it, so let's go back. Hang on to your seats. Ready? Here we go. I'll say this slowly so you don't miss it. If everything you can do today is primarily based on what you are saying to yourself about yourself today, you can change what you are saying to yourself about yourself when?
Today.
And what will your brain say? Okay. Is it true? Don't care. All I care about is what you tell me. Can you see where we're going? Wait till we get there. When I'm done, this room is going to be, oh my gosh. This is so cool. Because I'm going to leave you with a couple of things to begin using this as you're walking out the door. Okay? Okay, so before we get into that, we need to understand how much we can grow. Because people say to me, you know what, Steve? I'm 80, I'm 90, I'm 70, I'm too old. I just can't. This isn't much that I can do. I just can't grow. I've always been this way. I'm stuck this way. And so let's talk about how much your brain can really grow. Physiologically, so I'm going to teach you how we learn, so we'll do that next. This is our daughter, Sarah, and this is her brain without the labels here. This is what her brain looked like about 33 years ago as she was being raised in Rohnert Park. Any been to Rohnert Park ever? Okay, little teeny-weeny town. The closest thing to Rohnert Park is to a city in Rohnert Park is the Raley's Shopping Center. So Sarah knew nothing about the city. So Mary, who was an educator, said to me, you got to teach Sarah about the city. And I'm an academic. So I said, okay, I'll read her a book. So here's what I did. I read her a book about the city, and the brain recorded that book as a neural cluster. I'll show you a picture of one in a second. Right here in the prefrontal cortex, okay? I read her another book. The brain recorded that as another cluster. Then we introduced her to some people in San Francisco and some friends in Oakland. And then we went to some buildings and showed her some big buildings. And then we look at some streets and some parks and some lights and some cars. And the brain's recording all this stuff. This is what your brain's doing right now. It's recording what I'm saying. And it's creating little teeny weeny, itsy bitsy little clusters up here. Okay? Now, when Sarah went to sleep that night, here's what her brain did. First of all, her brain said, oh, great, leave me alone. for the next 8 hours, because now what I need to do is I need to make sense out of all the stuff that you've been giving me. So here's what it did. It looked at all of these various clusters and said, here's a book about a city. Here's a book about a city. They both have got people, cars, and lights, but there's no connection. There should be a connection there. There's a definite relationship, and if there isn't one there, I'm going to create one. So the brain created a connection between those two clusters with dopamine and synapses and synaptic clefts and axons and all this sort of stuff. And there's another relationship and another. And now what you're watching is you're watching Sarah learn. This is what your brain does at night when you're asleep. Your brain is more active when you're asleep than when you're awake, according to positron emission tomography studies. Okay? It's making sense out of all the stuff that you gave it. It's very, 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 very busy. This is why sometimes you have dreams in the middle of the night. This is why you wake up in the middle of the night, some just feeling really weird, because your brain's really working. And over time, what happens is the brain develops what is called a pattern of a city, long-term memory. And now Sarah will never, ever, ever forget what a city is. She'll know the city's got people, lights, cars, parks. I went to my 50-year high school reunion, and I looked across the way, and I said to Mary, there's Mickey, and I ran down the gym, and he ran down the gym, and we gave each other a big hug. We hadn't seen each other for 50 years. He had gained about 100 pounds, and I had lost all my hair. But we immediately knew each other. Immediately. Now think of this. How could the brain do that? How could I pick Mickey from across a gym with hundreds and hundreds of people 50 years later? Because 50 years before, I developed a pattern called Steve, Mickey, and he had developed a pattern called Steve. Now, ready? Exciting stuff. How many patterns can your brain carry? Let's ask that a different way. How much can you still grow? How much can you still learn? How much can you still change? Let's look at that. The ability for your brain to grow and change is based on those patterns. The patterns are based on the connections. So we can determine how many connections your brain will carry. That will give you an idea of how much you can still learn and grow and change. So let's do that. The connections are based on the number of neurons that you have, white brain cells. Okay. The latest study I've seen, the brain's got about 100 billion. Each of those are connected to an average of 10,000 other neurons. And that's not a multiple, that's a power. Can you see where I'm going? The number of connections that your brain can carry is 100 billion to the power of 10,000. That's a number we can't even fathom. Do you remember Peter Anakin was the runner of Russia's top neuroscientist. Remember Ivan Pavlov? You remember him? Okay. He was the student of Ivan Pavlov back in Russia. And he wanted to know, how do you write that number on a longhand? Now, back in the 60s, if you read the literature, which I have, there were about 30, they thought about 30 billion brain cells. So how do you write 30 billion to the power of 10,000 on a longhand? So he used a computer, and it came up with, you start with the number 1, and you follow it by 6.5 million miles of zeros. It's a number we can't even fathom. Here's a picture of prefrontal cortex tissue. Can you see the clusters there? Can you see them? That might be a book. That might be lice. That might be skyscrapers. There's the connections here. Dr. Ramachandran says on the bottom of page 8 that if you take a speck of brain the size of a grain of sand, you got 100,000 neurons and 2 million axons and 1 billion synapses in that little speck of brain. But my passion is to make this real to you. This is kind of psychobabble, and this is nice, and you'll say, this is really interesting. You'll forget most of it by the time you go to bed tonight. So what I want to do this evening is to make this stuff that you can begin changing the way you see yourself and the way you're thinking. So let's do that next, okay? I'm going to show you how many patterns your brain can carry. And to do that, I'm going to have you read this with me out loud. We'll start at the very top and go down to the bottom, okay? Out loud. Don't be polite. Say it out loud. Ready? The phenomenal power of the human mind. Can you read this? I couldn't believe that I could actually understand what I was reading. According to research at Cambridge University, it doesn't matter in what order the letters of a word are. The only important thing is that the first and last letter be in the right place. The rest can be a total mess, and you can still read it without a problem. This is because the human mind does not read every letter by itself, but the word as a pattern. Amazing, huh? Yeah, and I always thought spelling was important. Give yourself a hand. Now, let's keep going deeper and deeper. There are four misspelled words in that paragraph. Two of them are on the bottom line. What are they? Importance misspelled, go up one line. There's another one. Thought, no G, go up four more lines. You saw it immediately. On this line right here. Because, no U, what's the last one? Problem. Noel. Oh, my gosh. You have a pattern for every word that you know, every memory that you have, every relationship, every skill, every ability. And here's the exciting part. They are changing all the time. You know why? Because you have multiple millions of self-images. I was born in 1947. I was a baby boomer. My daddy came home from war, and I popped. I was raised with you have a self-image, you have to maintain your self-image. That was only partially correct. It turns out that you do not have one self-image. You have millions. You have a self-image for every single thing that you can do, every ability, every skill, everything, okay? Now, those self-images are learned. You are not born with them. You were born with certain natural skills. I was born with a natural skill as a teacher. When I was a kid, I used to put rocks in my backyard and pretend that I was teaching the rocks because I loved to teach. I mean, I was a weird kid because I loved teaching, okay? That's what I did, okay? So you have natural abilities, but your self-images are learned. You know what they're based on? Your self-images are based on your self-talk. Your best images are based on what you say to yourself about yourself today. Which means you're still creating them because you're still talking to yourself. Now, there's a number of inferences to that. Number one, your self-images are hardwired, which means you can't get rid of them. Okay? Number two, they're really, 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 really hard to change. Why? Because most of what you say to yourself is negative stuff. The percentages are 75, 80, we'll just say more than 50% of what you say to yourself is negative stuff. And this isn't just America, this is the whole world. Most of what we say to ourselves is negative stuff. So they're really hard to change. You can't get rid of them. So what we learn how to do, which I'll be doing coming back when I come in next time, is we create brand new ones. And how do you do that? You know how you do that? By simply changing what you are saying to yourself about yourself. And we'll learn partially that tonight. Isn't that exciting? Because when you change what you say to yourself, what does your brain say? Okay, is it true? I don't even care. All I care is what you tell me. When I first wrote my book, the original title was Making Your Mind Your Mentor. The publisher changed it, but I like my title better. A mentor is someone who sees more in you than you see in yourself. Over the last 70 years, I have become my brain's best friend. In the first 40, we hated each other. And now we love each other because we get such a kick out of the stuff that we do, mistakes or not. And that's such a nice place to be, and that's what my passion is, to help other people get to that point too. Wow. Okay. So let's summarize what I just talked about in two slides. The primary element that holds us back from learning and growing and changing is what we say to ourselves. The primary element that is holding you back from anything is not how you were raised, it's not what you've done, it's what you're saying to yourself, it's what you're believing about yourself right now. And this is what we'll talk about next. Why is that so exciting? Because you can change what you are saying to yourself about yourself when? Now. Listen to this. Do you know when your old life ended? It ended about a second ago. gone. That's when your old life ended. Which means, when did your new life begin? A second ago. Now do the math. If you got 60 seconds per minute and 60 minutes per hour and 24 hours per day, in one 24-hour period, you have 86,400 new opportunities to take a new life. All you have to do is choose how to do so. Extended out, that makes to 31 million per year. Wow. So, even though this is true, your brain takes shortcuts. What does that say? Bird in the bush. Does not say a bird in the bush. The bush. Two the's, okay? Right there. And yet your brain said, oh, I know this. This is so easy. This is right. Your brain is wrong a lot. And this is from the work of Dr. E.P. Seligman, author of Learned Optimism. Your brain is wrong a lot, especially when you talk about yourself after you make mistakes. And we'll talk about that a lot tonight. Your brain is wrong a lot because when you say things like, oh, I'm so stupid for doing that, what does your brain say when you say that? Okay, you say so. Is it true? Don't care. But here's the scary part. You keep saying that, and you know what your brain does? It rewires itself. Neuroplasticity. And you get stupid. But you can stop that when? Yeah. Right now. And what does your brain say? Okay, when did my new life end? 1 second ago. Isn't that exciting? It's scary, but it's wonderful because you really are in control in a sense. Not completely, but you really are in control. Wow. Okay? I showed this to Mary a number of years ago. We've been married for a long time, and she called me a liar, which is really freaking out. I showed that the A and the B were the same color. She said, you're crazy. The A is dark. The B is light. And she said, no, it's the same color. She said, prove it to me. So I said, okay, there's the bar. Can you see the bar? It's the same color here, same color there. Okay? But let's go back. What's obviously dark? What's obviously lighter? The A is dark. The B is lighter. What does the B have the A doesn't have? Shadow. Okay? So somehow your brain makes the shadow lighter so you can see it. Okay? How many letter Fs do you see in there? How many Fs? There's an F right there. Count them to yourself. Don't tell anyone. How many letter Fs are in that paragraph? I'll just give you the answer. The answer is 7. You skipped over the Fs. Because the Fs don't have an S sound. They got a V sound. You were taught to read phonetically. So your brain said, okay, the Fs don't count. There they are, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Isn't that amazing? Has nothing to do with education. It's just the way we think. This is our first daughter, Abby. She's right there. Hi, Abby. Abby, I need to let you know, was the most beautiful, perfect, gorgeous, wonderful baby. She was even more beautiful than your children were, okay? I mean, I'm the speaker, and so I can make that claim, and therefore, there you go. Mary's mother flew out from Michigan to see her first granddaughter. I was at work at the hospital. Mary called me. Mary was hysterical, and Mary's not the hysterical type. And she was crying. I could not understand what is she crying for. So finally, I just got in the car and drove home. And my mother-in-law is a wonderfully very sensitive person, and I couldn't understand what in the world Mary's mother said to her. So I came in, and there was Mary's mother patting Mary on the shoulder, and Mary was sobbing, and I sat down across. I said, what in the world happened? And Mary's mother looked at me, and she said, Steve, Abby's eyes are crossed. I said, no, they're not. Yes, they are. No, they're not. Yes, they are. We went back and forth for probably 3 days. Finally, we took her to a doctor to show you how wrong the doctor was. What did the doctor say? Oh, they were very badly, both of them, both of them. She had, I always get this wrong, strabismus on the right, I think, and amblyopia on the left. Anyway, she had to have surgery, and she had to have her eyes patched for a number of years, 2 days and 1 day, 3 days. And if you ever had to patch a two-year-old, it was really quite a challenge. In fact, the way she looks today is right there, and she's right back there, and I just got to get my picture in, okay? Now, let me tell you, Mary and I are really smart. Okay, we got degrees up the wang-wang. Okay, so we're really, really, and I mean, Mary's smarter than I am, and I'm really smart. Why didn't we see Abby's crossed eyes? Why couldn't we see Abby's crossed eyes? Why couldn't we see them? Why? Obvious answer. She's perfect. She's too gorgeous. She's our daughter. Nothing's wrong with our daughter. We could not see them. And that's the way your brain works. It's right there. And the brain says, I'm not going to see this because this doesn't line up with the way you think. So now what we're going to learn tonight is to change the way you think. Wow. Wow. So people behave and act not according to the truth, but the truth as they perceive it to be. This is Cliff Young. He's another one of my heroes. In 1983, he entered the first Australian marathon. Sydney to Melbourne, 885 kilometers, 545 miles. 150 of the top runners in the world flew out to Australia for this first marathon, and he showed up. And those are not Nikes. Those are called Australian muck boots. He was completely toothless. He was 63 years old. His coach was his 89-year-old mother. Okay, and all the reporters ganged up on Cliff. What are you doing here? What are you doing here? And he said, well, I spent my life in the outback. We have got a 2,000-acre farm with 2,000 head of sheep. I mean, this is a three-day race. I've run sheep for five, so I thought this would really be fun. So he entered the race, and, of course, with this kind of story, what do you think happened? He won. Of course, what would be boring if he didn't win? But listen to this. He beat them all 150, by a day and a half. Now, what did he do? Well, when you run a race like this, you run for 18 hours and you sleep for six. Cliff didn't know that. He didn't know you're supposed to sleep. So while all the other races were sleeping, he just kept on running. Okay? Now, back to my important spot. That is really inspirational. I did not drive my family down here to inspire you. Why? Because you know and I know that inspiration lasts for maybe 3 days at the most, and then we go back to our old ways. It's just the way we are. What I'm here to help you change the way you think. So let's talk about what happened the next year. The next year, he had the same race. Cliff showed up, couldn't finish it, injured himself. Eight runners beat his record. And the year after that, the year after that, they interviewed the runners. How'd you do it? How'd you do it? And they said, easy, we looked at Cliff Young. If Cliff Young can do it, I can do it. And what did their brain say? Okay, is it true? Yes, it is. And I'll show you. And that's when your brain becomes your greatest mentor, because he begins giving you messages that you never thought you would ever hear about yourself before. Wow. I ended up teaching math at USF, and Susie came to my office after the first day of class, and she said, Mr. Campbell, I'm just so glad you're my professor. I just need to warn you that I'm a C student in math. I said, what do you mean, Sue? She said, I've never gotten above a C in a test. I'm a C student. And so I worked with her. She got an A in the first midterm, and I gave her the test. I was so excited. She looked at the test, and she freaked out. She said, oh, Mr. Campbell, this is a mistake. I said, what do you mean, Sue? She said, I've never gotten above a C in a math test. She must have made a mistake. I said, no, Sue, this is a genuine A. So then she looked at it longer, and it's one of those moments you'll never forget. And a big smile creased over her face, and she said, do you know what this means? And, of course, I'm a teacher, so I sat right next to her, and I said, you tell me. I know what it means, Sue, but you tell me. You tell me. This means, Mr. Campbell, that when I flunk my next test, I can still maintain my C. I said, Sue, just get an A in every test. She said, oh, I can't. Why? What was her answer? I'm a C student. And that's exactly what happened. She flunked the next test. She got her C. Now, I sat down with her, and I said, Sue, answer me this. What would have happened if you would flunk this first test? Do you know what she said without a moment's hesitation? You already know. What did she say? I got it. I got to get an A on the next test to maintain my C. I will, because I have to. I said, Sue, just get an A in every test. She said, I can't, Mr. Campbell. Why? Because I'm a C student. I'm too old. I've never been able to do that. It's just too hard. I can't change this. I can't change that. This is the way it is, and there you go. Or my new life began 1 second ago, and I've got 86,400 more just today. And what does my brain say? Wow. Now, Now we get the good stuff. That's all introductory stuff. Now we're ready for the new things, okay? Tonight we want to talk about your feelings, more specifically when hard stuff happens. Because all of us are going to or have or will experience really, really, really hard stuff. And what do you do with the feelings? In terms of how you feel about yourself, in terms of how you feel about your life. And so what do you do with the feelings? So we're going to go back to the work of Dr. Albert Ellis, okay? What he suggested, and this is just as exciting as I shared with you before, and I'll say this kind of slowly, is this. And I'll share with you how he discovered this, and then we'll go from there. Your feelings do not come from events in your lives. They don't come from what's happened to you. They don't come from how you were raised. They don't come from what you've done. You know where they come from? They come from your beliefs about events in your lives. They come from your beliefs about how you were raised today. They come from your beliefs about what you've done. Now, why is that so exciting? Because you can change those beliefs. And the feelings follow. And that was what happened in psychology. Dr. Ellis said, feelings follow the beliefs. And again, psychology said, no. The beliefs come, or feelings come first. And studies have shown since then, no. The feelings follow what you're believing. So let me illustrate, okay? Let's imagine, what is your name? Kristen? Is that right? Kristen. Okay, let's imagine that Kristen and I have been dear friends for years. Our kids have played together and da-da-da. So I show up at Kristen's house with a shovel. Hi, Kristen. Hi, Steve. How are you? Good to see you. I'm going to dig a hole in your backyard. And Kristen says, weird, but okay. So I go to her backyard, start digging a hole in Kristen's backyard. She's watching me dig the hole. And she begins developing these beliefs. Let me see. Now, we've been playing for years. Our kids have played together. He knows it's my birthday today. Steve also knows I love trees and plants. Oh, that's what he's doing. He's digging a hole in my backyard to plant a tree for my birthday. Oh, Steve, you're so sweet. Call Mary. Get over here. We'll have pizza tonight. And I love you. You're just such a neat guy. Okay? Okay, that's one scenario. Another scenario is that we hate each other, have for years. And I finally show up at Chris' front yard with a shovel. I say, hi, Chris. I'm going to go to your backyard and start digging a hole. And I do. And she's watching me dig the hole. But this time her beliefs are completely different. This time her beliefs that I'm digging the hole to bury her in it. Okay? Now watch this. Watch this. Same Kristen, same Steve. Same shovel, same Saturday morning, same backyard, same hole, completely different beliefs, completely different feelings. 9/11 happened, you had instantaneous feelings. But over time, those feelings changed. Why? Because every single person in the world believed something differently. And the feelings follow those beliefs. Why is that so exciting? Because when you say, I've always felt this way, I'm stuck, I'll never be able to change that, your brain says what? Okay, you're right. But when you say, wait a minute, maybe if I change that belief, maybe if I've changed what I'm saying to myself about myself or whatever, the feelings will follow. And what we've discovered is the brain says what? Okay. And then it actually happens. So let me give you some examples here. Psychologists say that activated events do not lead to consequential emotions, okay? A does not lead to C. There's a B in the middle. B stands for belief. So here's some examples, okay? I must not be very smart because I'm so forgetful, and people used to say that to me. I would say, who said? Well, I used to be able to remember people's names, and I can't, so I must not be very smart, okay? Another thing that I hear is I'm not as fun because I'm older. And I would always say to people who say that, well, who said? Well, when I was younger, I was more fun, and now I'm not, okay? Another people thing that I hear a lot, because I said this to myself a lot, is I'm a failure because I have failed, okay? And I say the same thing. Who said that? Well, only people who fail are failures, and there you go, okay? You see, we think that events such as being forgetful, growing older, failing, explain how we feel. Rather, it's our belief about being forgetful. It's our belief about being older. It's our belief about failing that explain how we feel. Why is that exciting? Because you can change those beliefs anytime you want to. And when you do, what does your brain say? Okay, what if it's not true? Don't care. All I care is what you tell me. So let's go back, okay? I must not be very smart because I'm so forgetful. Well, I'm tired. That's one reason I'm forgetful. I'm stressed or I just don't even, it's not care. I just don't care, okay? Another one is, come on, be nice. Don't do this to me. Sometimes it does this to me. It just wants to be like a pill. There you go. I'm not as fun because I'm older. When I say I forgot, you believe me. Here's some advantages to being older. Okay, Tuesday shopping gets me a 5% discount at Oliver's. You get a 10% account from 10 o'clock till 4 o'clock on Wednesdays. Okay, I'm offered a seat in a crowded room, which is really nice. No one's hurt if I just leave a boring party. If I just say to my children, I'm going to go take a nap, and they said, okay, Daddy, that's fine. It's great. I love it. Okay, my outspokenness is now cute. Okay, and I can say no without hurting anybody. But here's one of the wonderful things that I discovered. I'm a failure because I have failed. You know what Thomas Edison was asked when he failed 999 times looking for the filament of a light bulb? He said, I did not fail 999 times. I simply found 999 ways it didn't work. Isn't that great? And here's the wonderful thing about being older. My dear friends, you've already made your big mistakes. Isn't that great? You've made the big ones. So the mistakes that you're going to make for the rest of your life are the piddly ones, the ones that just don't, who cares? Isn't that wonderful? You've already made the big ones. So they get you the rest of your life making the little ones. And from then you learn and you grow and you change. Okay? So let's look at the work of Dr. Martin E.P. Seligman, who is the author of Learned Optimism, and you can see him there. Basically, we have two dipped type people, pessimist and optimist. Optimist says, I happens to me, and this is the way it is. There's not much I can do, and therefore it's a closed system. Optimists say, no, I can choose. I can choose. I can choose to think this way, or I can think this, believe this way, and the brain says, absolutely. Can we become more optimistic? Absolutely, according to Dr. Seligman, but not through mindless devices. We can become more optimistic by changing our self-talk. So let's look at some examples here, okay? Crucial learned optimism is what we say to ourselves when hard times happen and when we make mistakes, because that's when we're the most open to being very self-condemning. So let's talk about that, okay? When bad things happen to pessimists, they usually globalize it. They say everything is bad. They eternalize it. They say it will always be bad, and they say it's all my fault. When bad things happen to optimists, they isolate it. So when Mary got her cancer, we said to ourselves, okay, here's the cancer. It means the radiation and all the other stuff that goes with cancer. But, it's not the only thing in our life. There's other things in our life that are wonderful. We're not going to let cancer be an umbrella over everything else. We live in Sonoma County. We've been married for 40 years. We have daughters who are married to men who love them even more than we do. We never thought that would even be possible, but they do. And as we said, we're just not going to let cancer be an umbrella over everything. And what did our brain say? Okay. Was it a one-time decision? No, of course not. We had to make it many, many times over a period of months. But over time, it became a part of the way we thought, the part of just the way of who we are. So that's number one. Number two, when optimists deal with bad things, they temporalize it. They say, yes, this is really, really, really hard today and will probably be this way for a few weeks or maybe for a few months. But, life is a moving picture and it's always changing. And the way I feel a year from now is going to be very different from the way I feel today. It's the dynamic of life. And I'm not going to lock on to, I will always feel that way, because when you say that, what does your brain say? Okay. But you can also say, wait a minute. No. And so we said to ourselves, Mary's not going to always have cancer. When is it going to be done? We have no idea. But let's lock on to that now, and let's praise the Lord right now for the fact that his cancer is going to be a temporary part in our life. Now, here's what's so exciting. The third one is that it's no one's fault. Stuff happens. There's another word, but you know what it is. I won't use it. Stuff happens to us. I wish it didn't. I wish it won't, but it does, and it will, and it has been. But we don't have to soak in our bad feelings, because our feelings are coming from what we're saying. And we can change what we're saying. We can change what we're believing. Let me give you one example, and then we'll begin to close. This is my first book, and it was, are there any computer geeks here? True computer geeks. Do you remember QBooks? Do you remember QBooks? Okay. QBooks, Q was the largest computer publishing company in the world. And they called me back in the 80s, would you believe? They said, we want you to write a book for us. Died and Gone to Heaven. And I wrote a book called Office 97 Complete, and I was so excited. They loved the book. And then Q was purchased by Pearson. That's why Q is no more. And Pearson never marketed my book. And I think we sold 18 in Australia. And I spent 2 years writing that book. Okay, that was it. But by that time in my life, I had learned nothing in life is wasted unless you say it is. So what good can come out of this? Well, I'm a published author. You know, that's impressive. My daughters were really impressed. Daddy, there's daddy's right there. My wife was impressed. My mother was impressed. And so, okay, I'm a published author. 10 years later, Sarah decides she wanted to go to USF. And we're very excited about that, but we can't afford it because it's very, very, very expensive. But we locked on to Sarah going to USF on a Sunday night. The next day, I was going to work, and I had been taking the same route for 7 years. This time, I noticed a sign on the freeway on 101 that said University of San Francisco. I had never noticed that sign before in the 7 years I had been taking that. Why did I notice the sign this time? Because my brain was looking for it. To make a long story short, I got a job at USF. Teaching for 10 years, and for every unit that I taught, they gave me a credit. And over 10 years of time, I made $86,000 with tuition we did not have to pay for either my master's or Sarah's degree, and the money they were paying for us on a book that never sold. Life is nuts. You just never know. You just never know. Okay, let's begin to close. As I said, the original title is Making Your Mind Your Mentor. A mentor is someone who sees more in you than you see in yourself. So now let's bring it all together, and let me give you a couple ways to think differently. Okay? Okay. What I want to do is to first of all look at a study called The Effort Effect in 1975. What they discovered is that most of us pass over our successes too quickly, too lightly for them to ever become a part of who we are. So when someone says, good job, do you know what we say? We say, oh, not really. You know, it was all right. Not great. It was, I mean, that's egotistical. Thank you very much. But, you know, I could have done better. I was part of a team. I was lucky. Thank you. But no, 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 no. Well, when you say no, 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 what does your brain say? Okay. And those compliments fall to the floor, which is not only a waste, but how sad. So here's your new way of thinking, okay? Here we go. When someone says to you, good job, you look great, you look at them and you smile and you say, thanks, I know. Now, I was down in Huntington Beach a number of years ago giving a seminar like this, an all-day seminar, which I'm giving, by the way, in March of this year, to 150 Kaiser physicians. And when I said, thanks, I know, they all laughed really hard, but they love me. They love me. They bought my book, my audio. When I was driving back to LAX, I got so excited, I almost drove off the freeway. So I stopped by a Chevron, got a tuna sandwich and a Coke, and I was alone in the car, and the car was gassing up, and I looked in the passenger mirror, you know, the middle one. I looked at myself, and I said, oh, you are the most amazing speaker. You really are. And what did my brain say? You really are. But you know what it also said, and this is again from Dr. Seligman's work, it also said, and hang on to this, I'll say it really slowly, it also said, and you could even be better. it opened up the gate. And I began thinking of all different ways to be a better teacher. I'll do this and that and this and that and this and that. Now, if I said, you know what, you messed up here, you messed up here, you messed up there, what would have happened to the gate, everyone? Slam shut. Okay? So let's make this doable. From now on, when someone says, good job, you look at them, you smile, and you say, no, that makes me feel really nice. And then you get by yourself, and you wallow in your success like a pig in slop. I mean, you wallow in it. Finally, and we'll close with this. Throw away the list. What's the list? The list is when you make those big bonehead mistakes and you say, oh my gosh, how could I have been so stupid? And when you say that, the brain instantaneously says, oh, I know. Remember that dumb thing you did yesterday and that dumb thing you did a week ago, a month ago, a year ago? Remember how you were the slowest reader in the third grade? And we get out this list. We start going down the list of all the dumb things we've ever done. Now, this is really important to understand. When you do that, your brain doesn't know that those memories happened a week ago, a month ago, a year ago. The brain's recording them again. But this time, as if they happened when? Right now. So here's your new way of thinking. When you make your next mistake, realize this. That you're still learning, you're still growing, you're still changing, which means you are still making mistakes. But just because you failed does not mean you're a failure. It simply means you failed. I was on my way to work one morning. I was waiting for the light to change, and a kid came up to me, drove next to me. I saw what was going to happen, and the light changed. He went peeling up in front of me north on 101. And I watched this whole scenario, and I said to myself, this is amazing. How many cars are already in front of him? Millions. And how many cars are behind him? Millions. So maybe it's not a matter of how fast you get there. Maybe it's a matter of you're going in the right direction. But even when you're going in the right direction, sometimes you just run out of gas. And sometimes you get a flat tire. And sometimes you even lose your way. But you know what, dear friends? You can buy some more gas. Or you can replace the tire. Or you can get a map. And what's so wonderful about the brain is the whole time the brain just saying what? Oh, okay. Is it true? Don't care. All I care is what you tell me. You say it, I believe it. You lock on to it, you know what I will do. I will do everything I can to make it true in your life. Wow. Thank you. What a joy. Thank you.
Steve, thank you so much. We really appreciate your remarks tonight. And since we don't have time to take questions in here, so will you take questions in the lobby?
Yes.
All right. And books are for sale in the lobby. They're already starting to sell.
And we're also doing a day-long seminar in March. And if you order it today, you'll get a copy of the book, My Audio Features.
A day-long seminar in March.
March in Santa Clara. There's a what is it, honey? Pardon me? Thank you.
Foster City. And my brain said, okay. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 114th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.